Welcome to the 101st episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. Today's episode is going to be more on the endurance side of things because I just completed the Backyard to Vineyard Biltmore Challenge, and that is a two-day endurance event, a half a marathon on Saturday. That's 13.1 miles for you non-runners and a 26.2-mile run on Sunday through the Biltmore Estates. That's the first time I've run a half and then a whole. It's kind of like the Goofy Challenge, if people have heard of those races at Disneyland. But this was all on the Biltmore Estate. And it was mainly in preparation for the upcoming Ultra in California in Mendocino, which is going to be quite hilly. And because I live in Florida, and the only hills that are little bridges that we have around here, we decided to try to do a race that had some hills for training and also had some distance involved to kind of get ready for that 50K ultra marathon in April. So it was a little interesting. As most of you know, I train here in Florida, and I had just been training on the flats. I've been doing more weightlifting lately with two sessions a week with some squats and deadlifts and lunges to kind of get my legs up a little bit stronger. But for the most part, just been running on my flat streets of Port Charlotte. So wasn't sure quite what this would bring. I've been having a little bit of an Achilles issue that's getting better, but still get stiff over time. So I wasn't sure how that was going to work for the race. So I decided it was going to be just a cautious training run type of race for me. We always watch the weather before races, and not only knowing what to pack, but the thought of getting wet and cold for prolonged periods of time, I've kind of had an incident way back when I first started running in Paris, where it was really cold, and I dressed very inappropriately as far as I had shorts and a singlet on, and I wasn't a very fast runner. And I got injured during the race and had to walk, and I thought I was going to freeze to death. It was about 40 degrees and sleeting, and I found a shirt along the side of the road and put it on and, walked around the rest of the race. And after that, I always think about, what happens if you have to walk during one of these events. A half marathon's not too bad because you're out there around 2 hours. But a whole marathon, especially if you have to walk or something happens, you can be out there, over 5 hours, and your core temperature can really drop. So I'm always kind of thinking about that. On the other hand, you don't want to dress too warm, and then you get hot and you sweat, and then you get really cold if you happen to stop. So that all plays into it. Also, I don't like to carry a lot of things, so I didn't want to have to carry jackets or whatever. So we were watching the race, and after Miami a month or so ago, it rained the whole time and was 55. I knew that I had appropriate shoes and sock combination for wet weather, so I wasn't too worried about that. I use these socks called a Ninja socks, or toe socks, and blisters are caused for the most part by heat and friction. And so if your feet are wet and they're sliding in your shoes, that's friction. And even though it's cool, when you're running that long, you tend to build up some heat. So that's kind of when blisters start. Sometimes I use Body Glide on my feet as well. But for the most part, my blister-free method to date has been wearing these Ninja socks. So that worked in Miami, and my feet were wet the whole day. So I decided that, I definitely was going to do that in North Carolina. So anyway, we were watching the weather, and it was going to rain, then it wasn't going to rain, then all of a sudden this snowstorm started to come through, and then it was supposed to snow. So we'd never run a marathon in the snow. I've run a few 5 milers in the snow, but never a marathon in the snow. So that made for some interesting packing in a suitcase that full of running clothes that are pretty light, that weighed about 40 pounds. So nevertheless, we took off for the Biltmore at 84 degrees on Friday. And we got in North Carolina, and it was 38 degrees and windy. So that was kind of a shock to the system, but good one because we're getting ready to run the next morning. We ate at a great place called Dream Curry House. And I had some yellow curry dish that night with some tempeh, broccoli, and red peppers, and that was really, really good. We get up the next morning, and it was 29 degrees, and I wore two layers, two heavy layers on top, and tights, and a beanie, and gloves. And it was dry, though, and a little overcast, but overall not bad. Again, you know, I was going to run that slow and see how my ankle felt and how I felt. And it started out, first 6 miles were uphill from the vineyard to the Biltmore Hotel, the Biltmore Mansion. And they're pretty steep. You know, even the hills that I've trained on in West Virginia, they were every bit as steeper. And I felt a little tension on my ankle, and it, you know, because your feet are cold and everything, and we had been in a plane and sitting down all day yesterday, I was a little stiff. And the other thing that I did was really stupid, which I tend to always do something that's really stupid during races, is I decided to wear compression sleeves on my lower legs, my Achilles and calves. I have never done that in a race, and that's one thing you should never do, is to do something different in a race. But I decided it was cold and my Achilles might be tight, so maybe that would be a good thing. So I stuck those compression sleeves on. And about 5 miles into the race, I finally dawned on me that, you know, I bet these compression sleeves are what's really causing my Achilles to be stiff. I'm not getting any movement out of them. So I actually sat down at about mile six and took my shoe off and pulled my tight up and got that compression sleeve off and tucked it in my pack. And that made things much better on my Achilles. Everything from then on out was better, you know. So I kind of wasted a few miles of kind of hobbling because of that. But, you know, stupid is as stupid does, as Forrest says. I also stopped and, you know, because again, I was, you know, kind of going pedestrian type of race, I stopped and took a picture of the Biltmore. Then I remembered my daughter would have taken a selfie. So I turned around and took a selfie with the Biltmore Mansion in the background. And so I ran the race around. So it was on the roads the first 7 miles. And then there was a little out and back on a dirt trail around a field, and then back on the roads, and then it finished with about 2 miles on a dirt trail that was somewhat rocky, but it was certainly not bad, and finished feeling good. And they had a nice finish. It's a very well supported race. You know, all the tables, they had goo available, which are the Cliff Gel products, and they had water and a non sport drink, and some cookies, bananas, and orange. I usually carry my own gels just because I'm not sure what flavor or brand or what sits best with my stomach. So I had my own. I took a couple of their Cliffs because that's what I use, the Cliff products. In the finish line, they had bagels and bananas and oranges. And, of course, they had cookies and bars that weren't vegan. But we got a bagel and some bananas and oranges. And that was all good. They had water, obviously. And you had a free beer if you wanted it. And it was pretty cold when we stopped. And they had a place that you could get at the Biltmore. They, you know, they have all the things remodeled. So they had this old stable that they had converted into, you know, a touristy area. So they had heat lamps in there, so you could get in there for a while. But we didn't take much time before we went to the hotel to get changed. After the race, so we went into town and we ate at a place called Doc Che's Noodle House, and that was really good. We also stopped at a vegan raw cafe and had some dessert, which was a cacao, cashew, date, and chaga pie. That was really good. And got some kombucha and went back. And then later on, we actually ended up getting a vegan pizza at a local place close to the Biltmore Hotel. I can't remember the name of it. But, you know, again, you can order pizza with the tomatoes. We had tomatoes, garlic, green peppers, and mushrooms. So it was a really good pizza. We also had some hummus earlier in the day. So, you know, we filled our tanks up. And, you know, this is certainly not traditional food that typical marathoners and endurance athletes eat. You know, we had the vegetables and curry the night before, and you know, then we had a lot of vegetables in the noodle house. I had, you know, some seaweed and kale and greens in my my noodle dish and carrots and mushrooms. You know, of course, we had hummus, which is beans. So it would scare a lot of people away. But, you know, it really doesn't bother you if you don't have the dairy and the oils. And I think that's what really gives runners an issue. And they blame it on fiber. And you see in Runner's World and everything that they're talking about fiber and don't eat that, need a bland diet before racing. And it just really isn't so. If you don't consume dairy, then, you know, your stomach really tolerates this food very easily. And, you know, we didn't worry about getting, you know, protein to heal our muscles. Because when you eat adequate calories and you eat nutrient-dense food, you're getting plenty of protein with that to replenish your stores. And, you know, in the reality of it, there's not terrible muscle breakdown with a half a marathon. And there's, you know, there's just no way that eating protein is going to repair those overnight, what little damage that there is. So you just want to get enough calories that you're actually replacing your glycogen stores, because that's what your muscles are using, and they're using that to heal as well. And the more vegetables you eat, the more antioxidants you get, and the quicker you heal. I always bring a ball with me that's it's kind of like a foam roller, but it's a ball. It's made out of some plastic type material that I can inflate and deflate. And so I roll around the ball a little bit to kind of loosen up. And I always bring a stick roller and roll it out just a little bit and stretch some, but didn't do anything too awful aggressive. The weather forecast, you know, that we were watching was snow 3 to 5 inches was predicted. So we kind of hunkered down and waited, and true to form, the next morning it was kind of a whiteout. The cars all were covered with 2 or 3 inches of snow, and it was snowing pretty fierce, and the roads were, you know, covered. And they actually delayed the start of the marathon by a half hour so they could salt and plow the roads. And luckily, we stayed at the right there on site, so we were about 1,000 yards from where the marathon started. So we waited to the last half hour before going down, and stood under a tent with some people and talked a little bit. They had some heated tent or heated lamps down there as well, so that made it nice. And it was kind of funny because people were, if you looked around, people were almost dressed to go snow or sled riding as opposed to run a marathon, you know, because what do you wear when it's, you know, it's that wet, slushy snow. But so everybody was in a great mood. We heard later that 70% of their volunteers didn't show up because of the weather was so nasty. And you know, I couldn't blame anybody either. The worst, you know, it's a lot easier to run than it is stand around in the cold and wet. But so the race got off, and it was just beautiful. You know, it's the courier and I've seen with the snow hanging on the trees, and it was quiet. The race wasn't very big. I don't think there was 1,000 people running on Sunday, and there was a half and a whole marathon. So there's certainly less whole. There's always less whole marathon than half marathon. I would guess. I don't know if there were 500 people running the whole marathon or not, but. It was small, and so it's spread out really, really quick. And it was just very peaceful running, you know, the snow on the trees. And again, the same course to start out with the whole marathon, you ran up 6 miles to the Biltmore Mansion. And today, or the day of the marathon, you know, the day before, the marigolds, I'm sorry, the daffodils were all out in the gardens, and they were all pretty. And the next day, the snow covered them all, and they were all wilted down. So I felt bad for the people that were running on Sunday that didn't get to see how beautiful the daffodils were the day before. But it was beauty in its own right. There was a few ponds and the snow around, and it's just very, very peaceful, nice meditative run, really. And I did not have my compression socks on, and my Achilles felt wonderful. I didn't really have any aches or pains at all. My legs were a little tired, but, you know, again, I wasn't in the mindset that I was going to push. I just wanted to get around 26 miles at a nice training pace and see how I felt. When we looked at the course map, before, it looked like the back half had some hills, but it didn't look like they would be as bad as the first 6 miles, and that wasn't exactly true. At 10 miles, the half marathoners went on, and the full marathoners, we went across the bridge and up a hill that lasted for several miles. It was pretty steep, and it was a muddy road that was very muddy because the temperature started to increase a little bit, just enough for the snow to melt and the muddiness to just come out. So the road kind of looked like when you see pictures of the Kentucky Derby after the horses have went through the dirt and, you know, tore it all up. That's kind of what we ran through. So it was pretty soupy up and down the hills and around. But it was there was a dairy farm and there was a vineyards up there. And again, because it thinned out so much, it was quiet and it was just really enjoyable. Up on top of the hill, I met up with one of the pacers and he was running by himself. Again, there's so few people in the full marathon and spread out so much. So I talked to him a little bit and ran with him a little bit. He was running 3 minutes and walking a minute. Typically, if it's during an Ironman, I run 8 minutes and walk 30 seconds. But during marathons, it just depends. A lot of times I'll just, I may pick a pace and try to be steady at it. I kind of do better at a steady pace as opposed to if you do the walk-run method, the advantage is that you can run a little faster between the walk breaks, and then the walk breaks allow you to kind of stretch out your legs and let your heart rate come down and let your body temperature come down if it happens to be hot that day. So, that's to each its own. You know, people can go quite fast and do a walk-run method. And, you know, the ultimate, or I guess the ideal way to run a marathon is to actually run a little bit faster in the second half than the first half and kind of hold back. That's not easily accomplished for most people because you kind of get excited and go out with the herd and you tend to have a goal pace in mind and push it a little bit. And then when you get to the second half, it's kind of holding on for the most people. But, you know, a good race for me is if I can run it kind of steady and, you know, maybe a negative split by a minute or so. But it's never a huge negative split for me anyway. So I was just trying to run a steady pace throughout. But I thought, I'll try this walk-run method with him for three minutes running and 1 minute walk. And I just didn't enjoy running a little faster for 3 minutes and then walking. It wasn't a long enough run for me. And I kept speeding up past him, and so I, you know, bid my farewell and went on my merry way and just decided to run my steady pace. And I actually felt really, really good. We got out. It was nice to get off the mud and onto a regular road for a while, and then you go back and you finish. And the one cruel part is that you go mile 20 actually passes the start line, so you have to go another 6 miles. You go 3 more miles away from the start line and then come back. And so that's always long because you've seen the finish line in your mind. You're kind of ready to stop. And so that's a kind of a long haul out to get to the turnaround. It's amazing. And it's one of my favorite parts of doing marathon is the mind game associated with running, because it really is. You know, if you thought about 26 miles, it seems like a long way. But when you start to break it up into increments, it's not that far along. And I always look at the course map before I run. We don't usually drive it. Sometimes we do, but most of the time I just look at the map and I get an idea of the geography. And, you know, I kind of know where the turnaround points are. And in my mind, I set, you know, what the halfway turnaround looks like. And, you know, that 20 mile turnaround, where I am there. And then I also look at that 23 mile, because once you turn around, you have 3 miles to go, you know that you've got it. And you know, it just mentally, it just gets better. You have a lot more confidence at that 23 mile, but that 20 to 23 mile can be kind of a long stretch. So anyway, it was a long stretch to the 20 to 23, but once you turn around, you start heading for home, you feel good. And there weren't very many spectators out. The weather was so bad, I couldn't blame anybody for not coming out. But the finish was nice, and again, they had the same fare. It was a very well-supported race, even though, you know, the volunteers didn't show up. They had the tables well-stocked. And, you know, I think, you know, if you've seen marathons or you participated in marathons, at those aid stations with all the paper cups and people take them and they throw them on the ground, and the volunteers, it's wet and gooey and sticky, and they're trying to clean all those up. And I just think that that's something that should kind of go away in marathon. It's almost, I mean, I know when there's, you know, thousands and thousands of people, it's easier to get water out that way. But I actually carry a water bottle with me, handheld. You know, it's got a little strap on it, and I keep it about half full, so it has about 7 or 8 ounces in it. And I can drink water when I want, because I usually don't take my gels right at the tables. And I kind of just eat them slowly, you know, as I think of it as a slow drip of sugar in. But when I get to an aid station, I just take the top off my bottle after a while, and, you know, I'll just top it off. And they usually have a jug of water, or I'll just take some cups and then, you know, put them back on the table. It, you know, it makes a lot less mess. I also carry my goo wrappers, you know, and I take them and throw them in the garbage. If you do an Ironman, it's illegal to throw them on the ground, which it should be illegal to throw them on the ground, especially, you know, you're littering. I don't know why it's not littering during a marathon. So I tuck the goo gels in my pocket, or, you know, my handheld has a little zipper pocket. I'll put them in there till I get to the aid station and throw them away in a garbage can. I mean, there's very few people that are running fast enough that this stopping to get water, or, you know, slowing down to pour water that takes 20 seconds is really going to make a big difference off their time. So I, you know, if you're just starting out running, think about that and all the trash and the poor people that have to clean up all that mess. And then, you know, especially in an environment that's out in, you know, in the wilderness and trails, that, you know, to litter on those trails, people can't find all those wrappers, and it's just, they're just nasty. So, and they shouldn't have to go behind you and try to pick up your litter. So that's just a pet peeve and aside from that. But anyway, the stations were well stocked with anything that you wanted. So that was really good. And then after the race, we went and had some more noodles at a Asian noodle place, and it was pretty good. And, you know, that was that. So it was really a good race. I didn't set the world on fire with any times, but, you know, my mission was accomplished. I finished well and had gas in the tank when I finished, and had a little kick at the end, and nothing was hurt. So I'm ready to go back out training. And that's the other thing about a, you know, whole food plant-based diet, is that I think the recovery is so much quicker than it used to be when I ran regular races. You know, you get back in, you stretch out a little bit, and I eat to when I'm hungry, you know. So I had one of their whole wheat bagels, and I had bananas, and you know, hydrated afterwards. And then we went out and got some vegetables and noodles, and you know, you eat when you're hungry, and you eat nutrient dense foods. And I really felt good afterwards when we got home the next day. I had a giant salad, you know, with beans and rice. And I'm hungry probably a little bit more frequently than usual, and I eat accordingly. But it's just a very, you know, my stomach is always feeling good. And my muscles seem to recover good. So I really encourage you to try to, you know, not to be worried about what you eat after exercise so much as just eating nutrient-dense foods that are colorful. You don't have to focus on the macronutrients as far as carbohydrates or protein. Just get what you would normally eat until you're full, and everything else will take care of itself. Asheville is a very vegan-friendly city, and there were tons of restaurants. There was a restaurant called Plant that we looked at the menu but didn't get to eat because the timing wasn't right. And there was another restaurant called Laughing Seed that had a lot of great food but had a lot of things had onion in it, so we didn't actually stay there because Michael has an onion allergy. But so there's just tons of places that you can eat there and be plant-based, which makes it really, really nice. The funny part about, we stayed at the inn at the Biltmore, and they had a very nice dining restaurant, and they had some Brussels sprouts, and they had some potatoes, and we could have made it work there if we had to, as far as food goes, but there wasn't a dedicated vegan option. It was very heavy Southern food for the most part. And, you know, that's a little sad on the part that, you know, at a, you know, an establishment where they kind of prided themselves on fine dining, there really wasn't any one plate that you could get. Like I said, you could make it work if you had to, but why make it work when you could go to all these other places that had vegan options? And, you know, these restaurants that we went to, not only, you know, did they have plenty of vegan and plant-based options, but they had them marked, you know, and they listed all the ingredients, and they had, whether it was vegan or vegetarian, they had almost every place that we did go had tofu substitutions available. You know, we were able to substitute other vegetables. So, you know, it made it such a nice place to travel to. It's unfortunate that the Biltmore, maybe, you know, I should write a little review and just kind of talk about that to them very nicely, that, you know, their competition in town has so many different plant-based options that maybe they like to offer one just if people wanted to stay there. You know, certainly Saturday night when the weather was turning, it would have been nice to have been able to stay in. But again, you know, we wanted more control over what we ate, so we voted with our wallet and we went someplace where we could get, you know, what we wanted that was plant-based and nutrient-dense. You know, even the coffee bar in the restaurant there at the hotel didn't have any vegan snacks for the most part, or a lot of fruit. So that it would have been nice to be able to have that available. But, you know, what you're going to do. We also stopped by their local grocery store. It was a Harris Teeter was the name of it. And they had a beautiful produce section. And we were able to pick up some hummus there and some whole wheat bread and a kombucha. But they had fruit available, you know, certainly. And so that's always an option, too, when you're traveling. There was also a Trader Joe's we just didn't go to because, you know, we've been to a Trader Joe's, want to see what Harris Teeter had. But, you know, when you're traveling, to just stop into a local grocery store, you can often, you know, find what you need to stock your hotel room up and have a lot of options. I had an email before I get off the Biltmore, I just also want to give a shout out to somebody that actually recognized me that listens to the podcast. I didn't catch your name. I'm very sorry. I wish I would have met you at the finish line. I kind of looked around. She was ahead of me. We were running out on the trail and she was coming back and I was going out, and she said, "Hi, Dr. Delaney, I listened to your podcast." And I was so shocked because the bibs have your name on them, but they're upside down. They're pretty small. And I certainly wasn't quick enough, and I guess I was in a stupor, didn't catch your name, but thank you for saying hello, and I wish I could have met you afterwards. It was really neat running into somebody that listens to the podcast, so that was very exciting for me. So thank you for saying hello. Also like to shout out to Michael. He won his age group, the 50 to 54-year-old in the half marathon. So he did well. He always goes out and runs hard every time he runs. So I admire him for his ability to just run hard and not be injured. I think it helps being a lifelong runner and having good, and he just has naturally good form. So he's fun to watch running his fast times. So the next race for us will be the Mendocino 50K in the third week of April. So look forward to that. That's actually a vegan-supported race by the Stanford Inn. So that'll be fun. A bunch of vegans running in the woods up and down the mountain. So it should be exciting. I got an email from someone talking about their kids and having a little trouble transitioning their family into plant-based nutrition. You know, when children are little, I think it's probably the easiest because, you know, you have all the options. If you put food in front of them and you don't make a big deal, and you can kind of puree things and add vegetables into soup and change their taste buds, and they don't even kind of realize it. You know, the smoothies can be all different. You can make a purple smoothie and you can have a fair amount of greens. So there's a lot of ways for little kids to start drinking fruit smoothies and vegetables in their smoothies, and then adding little, in soups, you add a lot of vegetables in, and you know, kids don't notice. When you have teenagers, I think this was kind of the problem with some people that emailed me, you know, teenagers can kind of be rebellious anyway, and there's a lot of pressure on them as far as when they're eating with their peers and going out with their peers and what to do, and how to transition to family. And you know, I was lucky. My daughter was well on board and, you know, willing to be plant-based from the get-go. Well, I should say second round of the get-go. When she was younger, she didn't want any part of it, and I didn't push it. But we always kind of ate, you know, more vegetables than meat. But, you know, one way to do it is in how the Campbells and the Esselstyns described to me how they did it, was they just kind of pulled, they pulled the meat portions out slowly without people noticing it. So there was meat on the table, but it became less and less, and, you know, beef and pork disappeared and the chicken started to shrink as far as the portions. And, you know, then it became, you know, that they just kind of, it just kind of disappeared and faded out. And they did the same thing with dairy. You know, there's cheese on everything. When you start to look around all the prepared foods you get out. So if you just start backing off of that and eliminating that and eliminating cheese from sandwiches and start substituting other things in, nobody knows. And again, you don't have to talk about it. And you can make some wonderful cheese sauces with butternut squash. And you can do some with, you know, a cashew-based cheese sauce. And a combination of the above. The other thing is tofu you know, nutritional yeast. And, you know, we'll make a ricotta type of, and lemon and garlic and pepper. We'll make a nice ricotta type filling for things that nobody really notices. So you can just kind of back the cheese out and back the dairy out without people noticing. You know, treats for kids, they make non-dairy ice creams that you can have, you know, once in a while. I don't think that treat should be every night. But also introduce the frozen desserts with the frozen bananas. And, you know, they sell a Yonana machine that you can put your frozen fruit by, and kids can participate in making soft serve. It's a bit of a cleanup and another expense. So I just prefer, you know, to take frozen bananas and or put the frozen fruit in a blender with ice and, you know, make a soft serve that way, and then top it with different fruit toppings and maybe some cacao nibs and coconut and nuts. And you can make a sundae bowl, you know, a sundae ice cream type of looking bowl with the fruit, and it's very good. And the more you have that, the more people start to enjoy it and like to make different creations. And it's very pretty to take pictures of. So I think you can get your kids on board pretty easy doing things like that. It's just a matter of kind of what you focus on. You know, certainly black bean brownies for a treat are, you know, certainly an option. But, you know, again, I just do more and more vegetables and less meat and back it out. And I think it usually works. As far as lunch goes, you know, making all kinds of vegetable wraps, they're really pretty for kids, and vegetable sushi, you know, and the sushi bowls to take for lunch. You know, I think that's really easy. The Lean Green Dad has, and they make the little slow cooker that you can plug in. It's kind of a lunch size to take soups, or, you know, most places have microwaves, so you can pack a soup in a for a kid to take. And they're even selling. I actually saw them at the Patagonia store in Asheville, in these wide mouth. They're like the old fashioned thermoses we used to have, but they're more of a stainless steel, and they keep hot things hot and cold things cold. So you can, and they have a screw on lid, so you could put soups in there and they'd stay warm for somebody to take in their lunch. So there's, you know, lots of options. It's just, I think if you make it look pleasing to the eye, and it tastes good, you know, chili's chili. Nobody's going to search a kid's chili to see if there's hamburger in it or not. So a bean chili is, you know, an acceptable lunch. And again, even wraps, you know, nobody's going to look in a wrap to see what it is. And, you know, certainly a vegetable wrap looks a lot prettier than a bologna and cheese wrap. So, I think that it's kind of more between the ears of people afraid to make the transition or just to not just do it. Pasta salads are really easy. Nobody's going to know. Everybody likes pasta salad. You don't have to call it vegan pasta salad. It just doesn't have any mayonnaise in it. It has, you know, a mustard type of dressing and, you know, some relish in it. So I think it's all in how you describe it. If you don't really just call it out as plant-based and vegan and restrictive, I think there's probably a lot less pushback than, you know, if you make this declaration in the sand that we're going to eat healthy and it's going to be this way and we're not going to have any of this and we're not going to have any of that. So, you know, give that a shot. And, you know, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. We also had, I had a question about type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes or juvenile diabetes is usually diagnosed in childhood. And it's more of an autoimmune disease where the pancreatic cells are attacked and they no longer make insulin. And so those people require insulin shots, and it cannot be reversed in the 99% of cases. It's a permanent type of thing. There is a link to dairy and triggering the autoimmune response and type 1 diabetes. So if you have children and you can eliminate dairy from their diet, you would really decrease the risk of getting juvenile diabetes. And, you know, if I had it to do over again, I'd certainly not have any of my children, or I would hope my grandchildren never were exposed to dairy just because of that terrible risk. But even if you have type 1 diabetes, you can certainly benefit from a whole food plant-based diet. I think I probably made reference to a patient that I have that, you know, has really reversed her coronary artery disease and a lot of symptoms from her diabetes that were long-lived. And, you know, she became plant-based only a few years ago and, you know, has decreased her insulin requirements. Humans require about 40 to 50 units of insulin a day on a standard diet. And so if you can eat a whole food plant-based diet, then the insulin requirements can go down almost back to, you know, that normal range. It's never really been shown that real tight control and excessive amounts of insulin is going to do anything for anybody. So again, eating a diet that's rich in antioxidants and flavonoids and things that decrease your inflammation in your body can only be helpful. And certainly the, you know, cardiovascular consequences are much more pronounced in a younger age in type 1 diabetes. So if you can eliminate, you know, anything that's going to, you know, accelerate that process, such as animal products and dairy and oil, you know, it can only help out. And it really, it bothers me when, you know, these people are told, you know, to avoid carbohydrates in the form of fruits and things, you know, at all costs, and to eat a high protein diet, and it really plays havoc with their kidneys. So if you are type 1 diabetic, I would encourage you to pull your meat, pull your dairy, and pull your oil out and watch how your insulin levels or your insulin requirements decrease over time. No, and then it comes down, how do you change? It always comes back to people do well when they're in the mode, but then they fall off the wagon. And so how do you evoke changes this quick versus slow? You know, especially with families, I would advocate, you know, doing a piggyback type method. So you kind of introduce a new behavior on a behavior that's you're already doing. So if you, you know, enjoy oatmeal for breakfast, add more fruit to it and make that a ritual. So just, you're basically changing your dietary rituals a little bit. You know, substituting another vegetable in. So maybe just, you know, adding that extra vegetable every night and just, you know, gradually decreasing that meat would make that worthwhile. Make your, you know, add the ritual if you have dessert, and, you know, start adding in the plant-based desserts. That's a really good way to start. So you're making your desserts healthy. So you're doing black bean brownies or you know, a fruit tart type of thing, or the big fruit bowl with some cacao nibs or coconut. And again, I like that ice cream bowl idea because people can kind of decorate their own. And, you know, it's refreshing, but yet it's really, really healthy. So that's another good way to try to get the behavior kind of ingrained, because it takes, you know, a good year for people's behaviors to become set, especially when it comes to plant-based nutrition. The last thing I'll talk about in this episode is the, you know, I'm still not losing weight. What's the problem? You know, it comes back to Josh Lajani, and his ghost portions always come into mind. There's just food there that you just don't recognize. Whether it's, you know, you're doing extra leftovers where somebody else is not doing the leftovers, or, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, an extra dessert here, an extra dessert there, or going out to dinner. I had one patient this week that, you know, she had been doing really good and her weight had been coming down, and then she really went off the wagon with salmon, and I can't remember what the other thing was for the weekend, and she saw her weight go up, and a lot of it was, I think, was salmon followed by then the Chinese food was the next day, and so she had a, you know, a salt retention, big sodium load, so she had water retention, and, you know, she had the fatty meal, and she didn't feel well. But it's sometimes it's kind of good because she thought she wanted the salmon. There wasn't a lot of other choices that she thought she could make. But then she didn't feel good after she ate it. Same thing with the Chinese food; it wasn't that good. So, you know, when you eat, if you can go for a couple of weeks and you're doing well, and then you have one of those episodes, just learn from it. You know. Be present for how you feel and how it made you feel, and think about what you could do next time instead of, you know, do the sides. And after a while, you know, ordering the sides become, if you're in a place where that, you know, there's not a vegan option, those sides become perfectly acceptable and you feel good afterwards. And then you can come home and have your frozen fruit bowl if you want. But, you know, it just takes a little bit, of doing it a couple times to feel comfortable. And again, if you have those weekends where you have an episode, and you fall prey to some of those other foods, then, you know, just note how you feel and go on about it. And if you're a diabetic, certainly check your sugars after those high fat meals and see what it does. If your weight goes up, look back and see where you can think where the salt may have come in. So I encourage you to look into that. If you have any questions for me, feel free to email me at jamiedulaney@gmail.com. It's jamiedulaney@gmail.com. Check out my website, drdulaney.com. It's spelled DOCTOR. I'm on Instagram with what I eat most days when I remember to take it before I start eating it. And that's at Jamila Delaney, as well as Facebook. But most of the stuff I post when I eat is on Instagram. This week in class, we're going to do stuffed tomatoes as an hors d'oeuvre and a bok choy salad. So that's a good thing to, you know, if you know what to have when people come over. The stuffed tomato recipes comes off of One Green Planet. It's basically a curried chickpea, curried mashed chickpea in a plum tomato. And the bok choy salad is going to be with oranges and pomegranate seeds, chopped up baby bok choy with some slivers of almond and a lemon dressing with a little bit of maple syrup in there to kind of make it kind of a sweet sour. So I hope you have a good week. Hope your exercise is going well. Next week I'll have Timmarie back to talk about some pitfalls of plant-based eating and transition. So have a good week, and thanks for listening.